And we're back here on Energy Wise, brought to you by the Cold Climate Housing Research Center and the UAF Cooperative Extension Service. Now it's time to take your questions with Ilya Benesch, who is also from the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. How are you doing this week, Ilya?
I am doing quite well, thank you.
First question. Kristen from North Pole wants to know how to get rid of carpenter ants without using toxic chemicals.
Well, that is actually kind of a tough one. The carpenter ants are pretty tenacious creatures, and once they establish a nest, they can be really difficult to eradicate. I would be up front and say prevention is probably the cheapest solution. If you can stop them from getting a foothold established to begin with, you're going to be way better off. This would involve removing any wood scraps, anything like that from around the house, old stumps. They're really attracted to moist environments, and particularly moist wood. And this goes for the house, too. Look for areas in the house that are prone to moisture. This could be crawl spaces, this could be basements, this could be the rim joist, sort of ledgered board area where your deck attaches to your house. A lot of times that isn't sealed well, and so rainwater runs down behind there and gets trapped. Carpenter ants love that. They'll get back in there and they'll work their way into the rim joist, and so a lot of times you can spot an ant problem or the source of a problem right there, even though you may see them in other areas. Even though they like wet areas, they are not limited to that kind of an environment. They will dig into foam insulation. It's a path of least resistance for them, so they can make nests in there. As a carpenter, I've seen them in every part of a house, whether it's the floor, the walls, or the roof. They will go where fate tells them to go. I completely understand the toxic chemicals issue. Unfortunately, it's also very effective when few other things are. And if I had pets or children or there's any chance for contact with insect poisons, I wouldn't want to risk it either. The other side of that, too, is that they can pollute, you know, groundwater, things like that. Birds drink that. Other animals get into it. So it's, you know, large quantities of insect poisons aren't a great idea. If you are looking at poisoning the ants, there are a couple options. If you are looking at something toxic off the shelf, a contact insecticide, really the key is find the nest. And carpenter ants are kind of interesting creatures in a sense that they will have one main nest. It could be 100 feet, 200 feet away from your house, and they are capable of creating multiple satellite nests that they use to forage, store materials, and as a staging areas to basically broaden their foraging grounds. This is often what happens in the house, is that you might get a satellite nest established. If you can trace those ants back to where they're coming out of the woods and find the main nest, it's a lot easier to take care of the problem there. If you're just dumping, you know, trying to kill ants in one spot in your house, that's not going to work. You have to kind of find the source. I'm kind of going on a little bit about carpenter ants, but I've just been around them so long and seen the havoc that they can wreak in different houses and different problems. It gets expensive. So this is a great time to look for an ant problem. If they're around your house and they're starting to get established, now's the time basically to put a stop to it. If you give them a year, things could get worse. I would like to point out, too, that a lot of the ant baits we see in the stores, they're imported. They're designed for lower 48 type ants. Those are ants that are attracted to sweets. Carpenter ants are foragers. They're a protein ant. They eat insects, protein type materials. The sweet products don't attract them, so you can get one of those little ant bait stations, but you'll run a greater risk of a squirrel or something getting into that than you might of an ant eating it. If I was looking at baiting something, I would check with a local exterminator. Sometimes they have protein-based poisons in a little ant hockey puck, and the ants can get into that, take it back to the nest, but those are a lot harder to find. Keep in mind, again, those are toxic, so I would keep them away from any areas where there are pets or children. There is one non-toxic approach that does work fairly well. This is diatomaceous earth. It is available at many feed and garden stores. It works because it's a physical killer, not a chemical killer. It gets absorbed into their breathing tubes and into their joints, and when they clean each other, they pass it around so it gets transferred from ant to ant. It wipes them out that way. Once again, you can't really dump it onto individual ants and hope you'll get the whole nest. You kind of have to find a concentration where the source is at. If you can get to that, then your odds of success are going to go up a lot better. Bottom line there is, clean your yard, make sure you don't have an environment that the ants want to move into, because once they find a stump in the yard, it brings them that much closer to your house. I hope that helps.
Wow, you are really knowledgeable about ants. Okay, next question. How do I keep my indoor air quality good when dealing with a Fairbanks fire season? That's a good question.
Yeah, especially in light of the fact that we've had a couple fires try to get started. Fortunately, nothing has gotten as dire as it has been in previous years. I'm thinking of year 2005, where we had those horrible air quality warnings. For starters, if you have an HRV system in your house, you're in luck. There are several local ventilation and sheet metal shops that can actually retrofit an inline filtration system that uses standard off-the-shelf filters. Usually it's a variation of a couple pleated sort of fiberglass-type filters and a carbon filter. And this filtration unit can then be mounted on the output side of your HRV, so it processes the outside air before it gets into the living spaces and filters out a lot of the smoke. If I had an HRV in my house already, I would look into that as a first option and consult one of the ventilation companies to see what they can provide. There are also a variety of freestanding air cleaners out there, some of which are geared towards treating smoke particles. A lot of them look at it as cigarette smoke, but at the same time, they should be able to deal with any kind of smoke and particulates that get into the house. In this case, I would be sure to buy the correct cleaner for the application. I had another thought, too, in this case, and this is visit one of your local ventilation contractors to see if they can stand or build some kind of a standalone filtration unit that can process the air in the house or draw specifically air in from outside and run it through some kind of a filtration system. So I haven't looked into that one personally, but that is something else I would look into.
What is the best way to insulate above-ground water pipes?
Oh, boy, there's been just about everything in the world tried in Fairbanks, some of it with more success than others. So I guess I'll try a shotgun approach here to things that I've seen that have worked with pretty good success. For starters, once again, I'll say that you pretty much want to heat tape in all situations just to be sure you've got an outside source of heat to keep that pipe warm. There's one or two exceptions, but heat tape in that sense is cheap insurance. You can always turn it on if you're worried. You don't even have to have it on the full time, depending on how you're set up. When you think about it, you know, a 1-inch water line is fairly small. It has a very small cross-sectional area, so it doesn't take much for it to freeze and crystallize and create a little plug of ice that will effectively shut your system down. If that happens, it can freeze back and either crack the line or ruin some other part of the line. Back to insulating, there is multiple ways of doing this. I'd say one of the most common is have one of the local spray foam contractors basically spray and foam any exposed pipes. This is a great way to go in a sense that this insulation is airtight and it's got a really high insulation value. In this case, you would want heat tape, and best would be if you could run that heat tape in a separate line right next to your water line and make sure that it's open on each end where it's sprayed. That way, if your heat tape ever goes bad, you don't have to chisel the foam off the line to get it apart. You can just thread in a new heat tape. It ends up being a lot cheaper in the long run, and heat tape doesn't last forever. If you're looking at saving money or want to do the work yourself, you can also build an insulated box with rigid foam insulation. Just make sure it's sealed tight. You don't want airflow getting anywhere inside that box. That'll really accelerate the cooling off process. Fiberglass alone for this reason is not a good choice. If you wanted to wrap fiberglass and then foam, build a foam box around that, that would be fine. Once again, you'd also want to run heat tape inside that insulated box. Another option, if you're in this kind of a situation and you've got a house where you can get to the floor underneath, keep the pipes up against the heated floor from underneath, and then you can insulate on the three sides that are exposed to the cold. What you're counting on there is heat losses from the house just going through the subfloor and the floor and keeping that pipe warm. And if there's enough insulation on the outside, you should be able to heat that pretty well. Once again, this is another heat tape situation. You'd still want that heat tape in there as a backup. I should say something about water lines, too. Pick a line, like either one of the PEX type plastic tubes or a type K copper that can handle multiple freeze-thaw cycles. Small, thin wall, rigid copper tube. It might crack the first time it freezes. So if you're out looking for water lines, find something that can handle at least a few freeze-thaw cycles and is tolerant of that kind of a situation. Another thing you can do is if you're building an insulated box and you're in a position to basically blow warm air into it from one end to the other, let's say you've got a water line running from a house to a cabin or to a garage and they're fairly close, You might be able to install an insulated box where you've got a fan under, say, a cabinet or something, and it's blowing air from the house into the garage through that pipe where the water lines are. That's another way to go. Let's see. The last one I could think of is buying pipe that's already insulated with foam. There's a couple companies, spray foam companies in town. They will pre-insulate that pipe in 10 or 20-foot sections. Typically would be like a 4-inch drain line, and it might have 3 or 4 inches of spray foam around it. Well, you can run your water line and your heat tape inside that insulated pipe. Just be sure as you put those sections together that you seal the joints on the pipe. The other thing there is some of those have a separate little chase you can thread your heat tape through in advance. It all depends on the product.
You are very, very knowledgeable this week.
I don't know what's up.
I must be on a streak.
All right. Well, that's all for this week's edition of EnergyWise. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, you can email us your questions at energywise@cchrc.org, and we'll see you next week.
If you want to submit a question to EnergyWise, email us at energywise@cchrc.org. We'll try and get your question answered on the air. For more information on EnergyWise, including a schedule of upcoming shows, visit the UAF Cooperative Extension Service website at www.uaf.edu/CES or the Cold Climate Housing Research Center at www.cchrc.org. Get EnergyWise. Save money. Become sustainable.